brought to you by Satanic International Network. You're listening to the news.
Upon decaying every foul wicked spirit in the host, the news.
20 minutes, Dead or Live, on the news, right now.
On the news, it's gonna fucking rock. Be there.
To really happen to have a serial crime
necessitates a certain fortitude.
Now on to our show.
Okay, it looks like I hit some technical difficulties coming into the start of it. I'm at work, so the Skype connection just kind of picks and chooses when it's going to actually allow me to be connected. For the past 15 minutes, I sat on my Skype on hold waiting for the show to start. And then, of course, the second that we begin to go live, I'm kicked off of there. So if everybody listening that's in the chat room, we'll just kind of put a we hear you thing there. Let me make sure that everything's flowing here before I start wasting any wind. In the meantime, I'll wait for that. I kind of want to put out there that Mr. Dan Dredd will not actually be able to join us today. He had some personal issues come up and he had to attend to it. So there's a good fine chance that this might actually be one of those shows that I'm just talking out my windbag self. In contrast to that, because Mr. Dredd is not here, we've pushed our topic off this week, and we're moving on to a different topic. I've got something that I hopefully will be able to at least have a little bit to say about it. I'm not real overly prepared, but it is something that I have been heavily paying attention to over the past couple of years as I've been studying. It's something that I think applies even to my logic as to why I was excited about bringing on the Fallen edition here, and that is the undercurrent. By undercurrent, what I mean is the deficient margin, or I'm trying to think of any other way I might possibly explain this. See, it's often categorized as the underdog, unpopular opinion, the exception to the rule, so to speak, or maybe not the exception to the rule, but the opposition of the rule. And in my mind, this all kind of boils back to a masculine, feminine overtone, and I think that's kind of the way that I was wanting to go about this today. Still waiting for the folks in the chat room to let me know whether or not they're actually hearing me. At this point, I'm not sure if I'm live or not. The Bob Cuck Radio has recently introduced a new switchboard called the Studio, and from time to time it fails. So we'll see if this is actually working right or if I'm just flapping my jaws. Again, people in the chat room, a little bit of something, anything to let me know, yeah, we're hearing you, everything's going live. Since there is no co-host today, I'm going to throw out the call-in number. It's 347-989-1371. If you think that you have something to comment on in light of what I'm discussing today, or if you think that I'm handling it incorrectly or whatever, call in. Let's do this. All right, so there is a popular sentiment that somehow what's logically right or logically justified should be what's prevalent. However, a philosophy that's similar to my own would look for the prevailing undercurrent to examine an aspect that, by and by is marginalized and largely ignored. And that aspect is the corrosive aspect of life. I think that the Hindus get it right when they assign Kali as the goddess of destruction and at the same time the nurturing mother. It seems whenever we're talking about things from the perspective of, a dichotomized look, things are either right or they're wrong, either left or they're right. They're either active or they're inactive. The dichotomy itself is an illusion. However, if we take the time to actually stop and examine, and again, I'm not, before I go any further, I'm not getting any kind of confirmation here as to whether or not we're actually being heard live, so I'm not really quite sure what the, whether I should keep running or not. I suppose the switchboard should at some point here. It should be, pretty loud and clear. It looks like the chat room maybe is just behind, and I'm not seeing that, so I'm going to try to reopen that up. And again, if you guys are hearing me, let me know. Raise your hand, somebody, hey, we hear you. That would be awesome. I can keep going at that point. All right, thanks, Ron. I appreciate that. Okay, that means I can move along. Some of the things that I associate with feminine traits or feminine quality is activity or creation. That seems kind of silly when you put it in perspective with my statement previously about Kali being the goddess of destruction. But if you think about it, all things have to, in some way, shape, or form, be torn down before something can be built. Before something can be built anew. And I'm going to go ahead. I've got a caller here. I'm going to go ahead and bring the caller on. Caller, this is Fuse.
Hi. Yes, this is Lord Bartholom on the chat room.
What's going on, man?
I have no idea. You still don't think we can hear you, but I figured somebody should have at least tried to call and let you know that we can't hear you and you are live.
Oh, yeah. What had happened was the chat room froze up, and I wasn't seeing anything going. So when I closed it and reopened it, I did see that you guys were acknowledging you could hear me. So I appreciate the phone call, though, man. And thanks for tuning in. Do you have any commentary at this point?
Well, let's see. At this point, not too much.
Okay.
But maybe I'll have something later when you get more into the topic at hand.
That sounds good, man. That sounds good. We'll go ahead and... in that case, thank you, and you're welcome to call back in if you do have commentary.
All right. Keep it up, y'all.
Yep, thanks, man. All right, so technical difficulties and all put aside, what I'm trying to get to, and apparently my phone's going to act up now because that's just the nature of this show from what I've found. I was getting to the fact that corrosive or deteriorative behavior oftentimes is a catalyst for building up newer and better things. I'm trying to gather my thoughts here as to all the things that I actually wanted to talk about in this category. So you guys will have to forgive my randomness today. Again, like I said, I found out this morning when I opened up my laptop for the first time in 24 hours and checked my messages on Sin that Mr. Dredd had an emergency he had to tend to. So I'm only kind of half got anything put together. But I wanted to kind of point out that from a societal level, certain things like empathy or not necessarily empathy, but like sympathy or pity, any kind of I'm trying to think of how to express this, but any kind of like compassion, it oftentimes marginalized and looked down upon as being negative in quality. Now, I'm not saying this is the prevalent whole, but what I'm saying is that we will at times, and it looks like we've got a caller coming on the air here. Caller, just hang on a couple of seconds so I can finish my thought. We are at times faced with the illusion that something is corrosive or deteriorative without realizing that it in itself is a necessary catalyst for moving things along. So with that being said, let's go ahead and pull the 540 area code up. 540, you're on news.
Hey, this is Betty Doom.
Hey, what's going on, Betty?
What's up, Beef? No, you were getting into the dualistic and corrosive aspects of this, and there was just one comment that I wanted to throw in since we're talking about the underdog. And that is there's another like very non-dualistic way you can look at it, and that is in almost a dialectical way, because you know we see when ideas clash that what was the underdog at one point usually, or no, not usually, but oftentimes goes on to become the dominant or preeminent paradigm further on down the road.
I would completely agree with that, and actually further it by saying that it is not even oftentimes, it is a constant rule. It is a constant rule that what you know was once dominated at some point breaks free of that submission and becomes the dominant. And so then the reverse happens, and then the cycle just continuously kind of goes that way. I think of several things just in nature alone that are that way. The sun rising and setting is a constant expression of the same thing that we're talking about.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, so that's one right off of hand. It's actually interesting. My whole coverage or our research as of lately has been very focused on the Hindu goddess Kali. And the reason is the dynamic of the characteristics that are being described in her. On one hand, you have her as this fearsome, destructive force. And on the other hand, you have her as this loving and caring force. At the same time as she's corrosive in nature, she's also nurturing. I kind of wanted to, and the reason that I was getting into the whole deal about being sympathetic or compassionate and that being generally marginalized is that those are the very traits that a mother will give their child, their young male child, and ultimately that helps to fortify him. Give him a stronger exterior because he has been shown that compassion and whatnot. I mean, Sigmund Freud would make the argument that that relationship itself is it's the determining factor for what behaviors will emerge as an adult. I'm not sure.
Kali is an excellent mother.
What's that?
Said Kali is an excellent mother.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what I thought was actually very interesting about the whole presentation of her, and my understanding is maybe a little more than maybe a little more than I don't know, a newbie's understanding of it, but one of the most interesting aspects of it is that when you look at Kali from the right-hand path perspective, she's benign in nature, meaning that she's really of no consequence. But when you look at her from the left hand, she's corrosive in nature. And that's really where the power of it lies. And when you break it down to an individual level, that corrosiveness is actually the building blocks that we begin to construct whatever it is we're constructing out of. So thanks for calling in, by the way. I figured you might actually kind of like this. You guys are... Without a doubt, the reason that I decided to choose this topic for the show. I mean, I think that the last night's show went very well. I think there were a lot of really nice things presented. I understand you had some technical difficulties. I mean, on my end, I didn't perceive any, but it does seem to be that was the case, so...
Yeah, about 70% of those technical difficulties were actually me putting down the phone to make a sandwich, and the girls got kind of freaked out. And I think I can, like, come forward and say that now.
Right on. So it's still the second episode, and it's difficult. I'm sitting here trying to pull a PDV and ramble off for an hour myself. And I gotta admit, I'm a little bit nervous, especially since I didn't take a ton of time to prepare myself. But I did break down some ideas in the past that I've kind of been working with, and that my proposition is that the feminine aspect is purely left-hand path. That underdog or corrosive current that existed, that undercurrent, it is what the left-hand path is in fact about. It's more focused on the good of the one over the good of the many. It's more focused on interior growth versus exterior growth. And when we try to transcend that bound, if we're not properly studied in both, we can create some major problems in ourselves.
Well, there's not a lot of game for a bad girl elsewhere, I gotta say that. That is one of the things I have always appreciated most about the left-hand path, is that it requires no compromise in terms of my femininity or my womanhood.
Right on. There's a lot of beautiful aspects. I shouldn't think about the cooling off of the day, the comforting going into night. That's as far as I can or have always understood it to be the feminine aspect. The night is always been associated with the feminine. The day's cooling. You're resting, recharging. But on the other hand, there are the fear of the things that go bump and woo in the middle of the night, you know?
Oh, yes, very much so. I mean, there's a degree to which, and it's just my opinion, all Satanists could be referred to as a Satan. And in that regard, you could also refer to me as a nemesis.
Right on. It's funny when you wrap the idea around and you bring it back to the fact that this is not necessarily a negative aspect. This just comes from a male dominant ideology that's existed for so long. And of course, it doesn't exist 100% all the way through, but as a overall social current, especially in the U.S., up until the past 20 or 30 years, and even today, it was a prevailing idea.
And I have to say, it's something that does violence to the spirits of men as much as it does to women, and that's something that's rarely recognized.
Right. Absolutely. I'm trying to wrap my thoughts back around that to what all the stuff that I wanted to cover. I I wanted to talk a bit about Kali because I think that it's interesting that Kali is never separate from Shiva, at least as far as I understand it. But unlike Shiva, which has been kind of equated to being a changeless mass of energy, Kali is that transforming aspect. She's that creative spectrum that kind of ripples through, giving, you know, Shiva the characteristic then of being absolute existence or absolute energy, and Kali being absolute power, which is different in definition only by a very slight factor, and that slight factor is the actual activity versus being inactive or what's the word that I want to use? I hate to say stoic, but that's the first word that's kind of pounding into my head right now. I assume then that Kali would not naturally be an ordered thing, and neither would Shiva, but together the two of them create order in each other.
That's an excellent way to put it.
It's just, like I said, my understanding's a little more than cursory, but it's something that I'm deeply interested at this point in. I have, for a long time, always felt that of the two genders in our species, the women are the more sinister by definition.
By definition.
Yeah, by definition.
Please don't spread that around, will you, please?
Well, it is what it is. I mean, I went looking today because I know in Irish mythology within the Celtic family structure, even today there is this this matriarch in each family, in each clan, that they're the prevalent power. They are the most respected power in the family. You know, the patriarch could be the greatest warrior that's ever existed, and even he'll take a knee to the matriarch. Because obviously, the relative importance of the feminine aspect there. And, but to kind of wrap back to that, what I went looking for, because of all the myths that I have seen, I went looking for some examples in history of wars that have been fought over a woman. Now, I couldn't find a lot in terms of actual historical fact, but the amount of myths that I found out there are just mind-blowing. I mean, I couldn't get through, you know, the 30 or 40 pages worth of them that I had dredged up just by Google searching wars fought over a woman. So I think that's interesting. Another aspect of it that I think is really interesting is the aspect that there's that old saying, behind every powerful man is a strong woman. I don't remember exactly how it's worded, but, that's actually kind of, that's another angle of it.
That works for me.
Yeah.
It's funny you mention Irish mythology, though, so shortly after mentioning Kali, because the figure of Morrigan, who, her name is complicated to get to the etymology of, but one very easy, cognate that you can see is the title for Great Queen in there. But
right.
She is very much an analog to Kali in many, many ways. And, the reason you made me think of this is because one of her attributes is that she bestows the right of sovereignty. And in many ways embodies the land, its resources, and as well the knowledge that is required in order to take kingship. The land as a woman kind of thing, I think is a big factor in these wars fought over women, because it's easy to embody virtue in the form of a woman. Like, we Lady Liberty, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I do.
Like, there are
actually
a lot of just female figures that are analogous to the spirit of the nation.
Right. The one example I can think of what I consider to be an undercurrent or a sinister aspect in the Irish mythology has directly to do with the Queen Maeve. Are you familiar with the story?
I am.
You are. So, yeah,
I would pronounce that Maeve.
Well, I'm just saying like my Gaelic grandfather did. He said it was Maeve. That's what he said. So.
Oh, then you win,
I've never actually... What's that?
Well, then you win. You can always pull that.
Yeah. He was actually, now that I think about it, he was probably the instigator for my investigation into the occult. He used to tell me all of these fantastic stories of Irish mythology, of things that happened supposedly within my bloodline. And it really got me curious. You know, every kid growing up wants to know where they come from. So the story itself of her beauty being undeniable, that in itself kind of it points to how the underdog could actually come up on top, even if they are the underdog. You know, that they have that one aspect that's undeniable or maybe addictive. I'm not sure what word I want to use. Again, I'm not super prepared, but you know, I have been kind of, you know, drudging along this path for a little
successful.
While.
And the Irish would
Pardon
write
me?
That story. I said subversive and unsuccessful. And then I'm like, well, the
right.
Irish would write stories like that. And these are a lot of the
yeah.
stories that that were part of what the canon I was raised with as well. And I got to tell you, there is something about that tenor. It's not like reading the classical myths. There's some pretty brutal shit in there.
Yeah. Yeah.
As there is with Greece and Rome, but I don't know. It has a very different flavor and always has to me. Like, these are barbarians that I'm reading. They are strangers.
Right, right on.
Yeah, coming from like that classical perspective.
Yeah, I personally, I've not done a ton of actual historical research on that. I thought the stories were good enough, coming from the actual storyteller, but that's a whole different aspect in the understanding of mythology and whatever. Anyways, is the actual value of the storyteller in the story, you know, the perspective gained. But that's for a whole nother show. What I'm actually wanting to kind of come back to is in our current subculture, I have noticed this push to somehow be on the, I don't know, the philosophical right foot, if that makes sense, to have the strongest argument, to be right at the cost of sometimes being philosophically inconsistent because of it. Sometimes it's better, and this is one of the things that I appreciate about Jason King, is he will often pick up the losing argument, you know, the one that he knows is the weaker argument, and try to make it strong. And that in itself, I think, very much deals with this whole undercurrent that I'm talking about here. And it's his understanding of the value of that maybe is the catalyst for why I personally believe that self-realization comes from this taking up of the weakest argument and, really putting it to the test and doing your best to fortify it. Now, I don't mean, you know, blindly just accepting it or putting it into place because it's the weakest argument, but rather trying to you know, break it apart, destroy it, take it down, and see what comes back when you start to build it back up again.
It keeps the game interesting at the very least, because I would rather take, I would rather throw in with a position I actually don't agree with if the alternative, if the person expressing my position is really just engaged in intellectual masturbation, you know, if they're playing whack-a-mole with somebody that is so obviously their inferior that it wins them no honor whether or not they're right, then, yeah, no, I can definitely do that.
Right.
But I'm going to drop off the line real quick because I think some other people may want to call in.
Okay, that sounds fine, Betty. Thanks for calling in. Appreciate it.
All right. Yeah, good as always.
All right. So I went ahead and put Betty on mute, and she'll fall off here in a second. Other people that have commentary on this, you know, you guys know the number. 347-989-1371. Let's talk about the undercurrent, the underdog, the corrosive aspects. Let's you know, take a look at you know, that fine hairline split that manifests itself in a dichotomy from one perspective. In the meantime, I'm just going to kind of here look at my notes. I trampled back one way or the other trying to fill in and actually hold some kind of a conversation with Betty, who's admittedly probably miles smarter than me. But one of the things, and I'm going to kind of go back to this collie thing, because again, this has been my focus for a while. I've been kind of studying and looking at this whole thing and trying to make sense out of it from a Western minded perspective. Shiva is often associated with function, where Kali is associated with manifestation. And I think that's interesting because it seems, from my perspective, when I'm reading about this, that Shiva would be the encompassing of all things. All things, their order, their process, whatever systems they work within, but it takes Kali to actually manifest and create movement within those things. And on that note, it looks like Chicken Wings is calling in to probably kick me in the teeth. JK.
Chicken Wings? What is that, like a
What's
cult
up,
or
man?
Something? It should be a cult of the Chicken Wings. I think we should start that. Like that
there
would be,
is.
What would that be? That would be the COC, wouldn't it? Cult of Chicken Wings.
The Cult of Chicken Wings, that's right.
Something like that. It would be something like that, wouldn't it? Then I could go
would.
And declare myself the High Priest Ipsissimus. All kind of nonsense. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah.
Man,
I hard booted my
my phone, man. So I got my phone back.
Awesome. Awesome,
yeah,
awesome.
It kind of sucks. Now I can take my ringer and put my ringer back on because I've had my ringer turned off and shit. Anyway, so what the fuck are we talking about, man?
Before we do actually go what we're talking about, man, I do want to congratulate you on your recent ascension to Mega High Priest.
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you so much. Jorge's clapping. You can't hear it, but he's clapping.
Good for Jorge. I'm at this point just kind of rambling on because I'm trying to, in some way, straighten out everything that I've been thinking in terms of what the aspects of Kali versus the aspects of Shiva, and how Kali is actually a representation of the underdog or the undercurrent, but a very necessary representation.
Well, I mean, I personally don't see it that way at all, but... That's just me, maybe.
Well,
man,
enlighten me, man. I mean, really, like I said, my understanding is maybe just slightly more than cursory.
Kali to me is what might be termed black time, which is just essentially that time is destructive in and of its very nature. I don't want to say that makes Kali more passive than Shiva. Within the paradigms, though, it kind of does, simply because Kali is more like, she's the feminine, so she's like more like Mother Nature, kind of like the inevitability of the return. The very fact that destruction occurs, whereas Shiva is, you know, maybe creation out of destruction, if that makes any sense. So I would see Shiva as being the active force in that. The two are not always paired off against each other. That's another thing. I mean, it just kind of depends on, it's kind of like the Egyptian system. When you're talking about these old systems like that, these systems that go back millennia, you can kind of pair off any god against any goddess within any sub-paradigm within those, you know, which is why some people have fun with, like, for example, in the Egyptian system, Osiris, they have a lot of fun with that, or like Set even, they have a lot of fun with that because they take it within this small, we might consider to be big, though, because, like, for example, the United States has been around, what, like 350 years, something like that. To them, that's small time. I mean, when you're talking about these cultures that have been around for, you know, 300 and 400 millennia, to talk about, like, you know, 200-300 years, that's small time. So you can pick any, you know, subsystem out of the larger thing, and then there really is no larger thing within either system, within either the Indian or the Egyptian. There is no overarching system. There's just a bunch of smaller systems that kind of fit together because they use the same names. And so, you know, like even joining Kali to Shiva is problematic in some sense because, you know, well, whatever. I mean, it's problematic because they in some senses represent the same thing, but just seen from different angles. And so you might be able to see them as being kind of like flip sides of the same coin in a way, but whatever.
I honestly think that it's even maybe just beyond the surface level, less deep than that, in that they're not necessarily flip sides of the same coin, but maybe different features on the same side of the coin, at least as I've come to understand it. The way that I can kind of say this, that they both represent consciousness in some ways, but as far as we differ in the fact that you think that Kali is passive, and from what I've seen, it's a very active force instead. But I mean, we could be talking about the same thing again, and just understanding it from a slightly different perspective.
Well, actually,
or looking at it.
To cut you off slightly, I don't think I ever said that Kali was passive. I thought you said that.
No.
Okay.
If that's the case, then my apologies. I misunderstood you.
Well, no. See, I'm trying to avoid, you know, the Western dichotomy that we generally sometimes get into, which is like what is basically Hermeticism. In other words, one of my biggest problems with Hermeticism, although I think it does have a lot of wisdom to offer, is that it overly dichotomizes things into, like, if this is wet, this is dry. Or if this is wet, that is dry. Or if this is hot, that is cold. You know, for everything, the other thing has to be the exact opposite. And I don't think the Eastern philosophy fits into that same mold exactly. It is dualistic, but it's not dichotomous in its dualism, if that makes any sense at all. And so, you know, I don't see Kali as being passive in any stretch. I mean, I thought that was the whole thing of the undercurrent, the underdog, the thing you were talking about. I'm sorry, I missed what you were saying. But
No, that's all good, actually. That's a good point of clarification in my mind, because I was specifically calling Kali active rather than passive, and Shiva passive. I see Kali in this sense as being the catalyst. That's why she's labeled the goddess of destruction, because anytime that, you know, a period of space is emptied, something's got to take its place. You know,
they're both concepts of destruction. There's just merely a masculine and a feminine difference between the destructive nature. They're both destructive aspects. There's no question about that.
That's interesting. Could you? I mean, I know it's offhand, off the fly, but could you point to maybe some spot that is prevalently obvious? Because what I've kind of come to understand about Shiva is he intentionally pacified Kali.
Well, again, what I'm trying to say is that you're looking at, you know, you can look at within a, you know, 3,000-4,000 year mythic cycle, you can look at any one stretch of that and say, okay, well, this is dominant or that's dominant within this time frame. What you're dealing with is under all of it, you know, you have these three concepts within the Indian system of Brahma, without the N. With the N is a big difference, and that's kind of funny. You throw that N on the end of it, and it becomes like God uncapitalized in the West, which is weird. But Brahma, he's the creator. Then you have Vishnu, he's the preserver. And then you have Shiva, the destroyer. They work together to preserve the cycle. They're like the three gods that preserve the cycle within one understanding. But the idea behind that is that, and actually Shiva is the oldest of these three. It's kind of hard to argue that with Brahma, just because, well, that might be a more philosophical concept than it is a deific concept, if that makes any sense at all. It was ultimately deified. But the idea behind it is that the Indian system ultimately understands that destruction, or that the change of form, or what we might call Heraclitean flux in the West, within the Greek schools, the early Greek schools, is the ultimate nature of reality. And this is Buddha's whole fucking spring point in his philosophy, was that there's nothing, not even the Atman is real. Even the Atman is illusory, because even that falls victim to flux and change and destruction of form. No form is real ultimately, because every form passes away. And that statement, the statement that no form is real and that all form passes away, that is Shiva. That is the nature of Shiva. Kali is just slightly older than that. When I say older, I don't mean older within the myth system, but I mean older mythically, if that makes any sense at all. I don't mean she's chronologically older, but I mean she's in the myth structure older. It would be kind of like within the Greek system, you have that goddess Nox that preceded everything, Nox meaning night, whatever. Does that make any sense? The oldest of the, you know, old gods that nobody talks about. Kali is kind of like the background against which all of that happens. And so it's kind of like, you know, you have within, for example, physics, you have, you know, nature, but then you have the laws of nature. You know what I mean? And there's a fine line between that. Like, nature is the activity of it, and then the laws of nature are that thing by which it happens and the background against which it happens. And so I would say that the former is, meaning in this case, nature, the activity of nature, et cetera, would be Shiva, and then Kali would be the background again against which it happens, and that's the active and the passive. But the active and the passive in their system is different a little bit from ours, but not by much, but just a little bit. It's a subtle.
That fits very well into how I understand this, actually. It has come to be my perception that Kali is the reflected aspect of Shiva, the active, the perceived aspect of Shiva. That's why often I've seen pictures of of I'm trying to think of how to explain this. Yeah, damn, the thought's gone. Where was I at? The reflection, the mirror image. But it's not just the image that's reflected. It's not the opposite because it's the image reflected. It's the perception of that reflected image. At least that is my understanding of what one could understand as Kali.
Well, you know, one of the ways they do that in Eastern iconography is they have the dude fucking the chick on his lap. I'm sure you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yes, I do. I do.
Okay.
And
it's an awesome picture, though, isn't
also,
it?
Yeah, it's often also depicted in this, he's laying on the ground in front of her as she's standing one foot on him as if she's dominated or conquered him already, and that that's the same thing. I mean, when you think about domination from the aspect of sexuality, it's usually the person who's on top that is considered to be dominant in that particular cycle that's happening. So,
well, you know what I find interesting is that in the Eastern iconography, you don't find this asexuality that you do in the West. Like, in the West, there's this big, like sexuality is almost a taboo. I'm not going to say it is a taboo, but it's almost a taboo in the West. In the East, it was used for mythic purpose, which is why, of course, Tantra, you know, being translated roughly as some people do, which is not really, but that's a small aspect of it, into sex magic or something like that, just because they understood that all magic is sex. And sex equals
right.
Death. Sex equals death, which is where we get back to Shiva Kali, which is the destruction cycle. They were so far, I've said this so many times, they were so far ahead of the West in so many ways, it's not even funny. They had so many insights that were just so deep. That we're finally even catching up on. I mean, they discovered, you know, atomism and fucking idealism and almost everything you can imagine philosophically. They discovered that way before Greece did. And I'm not saying that the Greeks did it wrong or anything like that, but they were late. But whatever.
Right. Another thing, and I would hate to end this show out without making mention of this, since we've kind of already touched on it, is the actual promiscuous sexual or sensual aspect that is often perceived as part of the undercurrent. That's something I wanted to make mention of here as well. Often
only among human beings. Only among human beings, not among, I mean, I see, you know, animals fuck whenever they want, And when
right.
And even in the animal kingdom, and this is something I don't want to really get off on a whole tangent about, but in the animal kingdom, there is not really a fine line between rape and sex. But I'm not going to get into that either.
I would have to agree with you in that line is only perceived on our level.
I agree. That's what I'm saying, essentially. But that's a whole that's going to carry us too far afield. But you know,
all right. Well, and to tap back real quick on sex magic, I believe there was a dude named Samuel War. I think that's his last name. W-O-R-E.
W-O-E-R, I believe.
W-O-E-R. That's it. Yeah. And he actually wrote a book that it's fairly decent. I mean, some of it I chalked up as cockamania horse shit, but he had a pretty firm understanding of the Eastern aspects of it from what I could see. So, again, my understanding of this is little more than, I don't know, a surface deep understanding, but it's something that I've been struggling to really comprehend for a while now. So I just thought it would be, you know, interesting to throw that out there. So if anybody wants to take a look at his works out there and you know, decide for yourself, it's at least worth the read. So blah, blah, blah. Yeah. 10 minutes left, dude. I'm not going to beat this to death. I don't know if you want to talk for a few minutes about your new acquisition, or if we've got a new chicken wings recipe on the grill or something. But
you're killing me, man. No, man, I just like the wing of the chicken, man. That's all, you know, that's all it is, man. I mean, I'll cook some mango like fried rice and have that be a recipe. No, I mean, I do cook. I mean, there's no doubt about it. I cook different shit all the time. I mean, my chili is to die for, but there's, you know, whatever. No, I mean, my new acquisition, I mean, I'm thinking about in a day or two just dissolving it completely. I mean, I subsidiarized it or made it a subsidiary of Sin, but, you know, I'm thinking it's pretty much dead and defunct as it is, and so why not just bury it? I mean, it's dead, why not bury it, right? But whatever, you know. As for, you know, what you were talking about, the undercurrent, what have you, sex and magic are only separate in the West, where we have, for whatever reason, and this would be an interesting, you know, line of thought as well, is to understand why we have labeled sex in the West a taboo in a lot of ways. I mean, you're looking at it now with the whole, you know, same-sex marriage thing and how that's so problematic and how it's, you know, dragging its heels to get through legislation, et cetera. We've done the same thing with drugs. They don't have these problems, particularly in the East. They have other problems, which we don't have in the West. I mean, in the East, they tend to be so pacifistic when it comes to property and things like that, that they're not as productive. So I see, you know, value in both systems and probably the middle ground, but, you know, I just kind of wonder where a lot of the neurosis comes from in the West with regard to sex and all that, you know, shit.
I actually have a theory, and this is something that I've been tossing back and forth, and that is that it's because of the predominant sun worship that we stem from. That the sun worshipers themselves, for whatever reason, you know, they were purely all about the masculine aspects, and of course, no guy really, I should say most of the guys out there that I know aren't that interested in having sex with other men. And so
yeah,
if
you can put me in the group of not interested, thank you.
yeah. Right on. But what I'm saying is that if your interests are heavily male-oriented, and then you add the element of sexuality on top of it, the only way that you can avoid having some drunken mishap is to alienate the idea of sexuality at all.
So what you're saying is that it's like an overabundance of Trump 4 or the Emperor Ascendant or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I'm arguing for, yes.
Yeah, I can kind of see that in the West. I mean, you know, I haven't really tried to wrap my head around the issue completely. I mean, it's just, like I said, something that I, you know, I ponder every now and again, although on a little bit, you know, different scale as far as, because my problems are a little bit more pressing than, you know, somebody else's neurosis. Sometimes I do wonder about the overriding neurosis in this culture, but whatever. I mean, it is a more productive culture. So, yeah, maybe that is what it is. It's like masculinity ascendant, because the masculine is generally within, you know, the species going to be the more ascendant of the two insofar as, like, activity is concerned, simply because that's what the woman wanted the man to do when she created him. So.
Right.
Yeah, but whatever.
that's really, with 4 minutes left, that I think that would push us over in terms of content. If we
let's talk about some real big shit, motherfucker. No, I'm just kidding.
Yeah, I do. However, I think that there's something to that, and I've been kind of, you know, studying in the background to try to figure it out. Because unlike you, I went to to remove these neuroses from all the elements that interact with me and myself. And so I am focused on it somewhat. I'm not saying that you don't want to remove the neurosis, but what I'm saying is you're not concerned with it like I am.
I'm a mega high priest. What the fuck am I concerned about?
Right.
I'm at the top of the food chain. I'm the boss. I'm the man. I mean, what the fuck?
Huh?
I say jump, and what's your response? How high, motherfucker? That's what you say. You say, how high, motherfucker? And I'm like, who you calling
right
motherfucker,
on.
God damn it? No, I'm kidding. Go ahead, man.
No, it's good, man. I think the show turned out okay, man. I'm really kind of scratching my head. I mean, I put together the idea of doing this about an hour beforehand, actually about an hour and 15 minutes beforehand. And, you know, I didn't want to ruin the topic Dan had picked out for us by, you know, doing some long monologue on it and then leaving nothing for us to actually discuss when he's present next week. So I thank you and Betty both for calling in. You guys definitely added to it. I'd still be fumbling around and all the different things I wanted to cover. I think I missed about half of the list, so.
It's always best to have more to talk about than that you ran out of shit to talk about, right, Paul?
Right. Well, the whole thing of it when approaching it for me is it's just so interweaved into everything. It's not as separate as I'm trying to make it sound, and I know that. So picking a starting point and then trying to figure out how to follow that string through each little weave that it makes and every knot that it ties, I wasn't really sure where to start to make it as easy as, and then it didn't help that the second that we went live, my Skype connection killed out and I had to race to get my phone to connect. So
I actually thought that was my computer. My computer has been on the fritz a little bit lately, so yeah.
Yeah, that reminds me. I need you, while I got you on the air, I need you to write down the model number that you have in your computer and send it to me private message. I've come across a couple of parts that may be compatible with your computer. So.
I'm going to buy a new computer pretty soon. If I have to do nothing but cash out a couple weeks vacation, I'm going to do it. And this computer is just, it's balls old. It's older than my daughter, which is saying something.
Right.
So it's like, it's almost 10 years old. So
what I'm saying to you, though, man, is that
I don't want parts, goddammit. That's what I'm saying, motherfucker. I don't want parts. Parts.
No parts. You don't want to go the frugal route?
No, dude, I'm going to buy something. I'm going to buy, like, a laptop, or I might even do one of those fucking tablet deals. Just get it brand new.
Yeah, you should definitely get a tablet, man.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. That was my preference, but, you know, whatever.
Right on. All right, dude, well, it's time to end the show, so thanks a lot, bro.
Yeah, no problem. Anytime, man.
All right, I'll talk to you later, dude.
All right, dude.
Thank you for listening to the Ooze. Opinions expressed by our guests or callers do not necessarily represent the opinions held by TC, Zach, Jason, Matt, or any other institution represented by them. If you have been offended by the production of this show, we are sorry, but as the old expression goes, come along. Special thanks to Dr. Rocky DeRoma for his contribution to this outro. The Ooze is a Creative Oddity Studios product and is presented by Titanic International Network as its official Blog Talk radio show. Why waste your time with those other guys?